ever feel that God is invisible? That he is absent from the world? That he might not be active right now? Do you ever wonder how we should act in a world where others seem more powerful? Where governments seem to be in total control? Where God's people get sidelined? Did you know there's a Bible book all about that? Over the next few weeks, I'm going to be sharing my sermon series from the book of Esther. Esther's a book where God's name doesn't even come up once. But when we look carefully, God is extremely active. It's a book with conspiracies, misuse of power, supposed coincidences, relationships, and far more. Are you intrigued? Well, let's dive in, shall we? How should we live in this world missing God? How should we live in this world missing God? That is the big question the book of Esther is answering for us. As I say, we've spent 6 months on and off in this book. It's not an entire 6 months because we have had breaks in the middle and things have happened. But I don't know about you, but those 6 months, that 5 hours, I found it so interesting and so useful. Let me admit something to you. Prior to studying this book, I would have assumed it was a story that was for the edges. A story that doesn't have much to say to us today. In fact, it's just one of those stories that's good for the kids. But I know I say this to everyone all the time. As always, God's word is relevant to us if we spend the time reading it and diving into it. And how quickly, and we saw how relevant it was. Because that world that's missing God, that Esther describes, is the world we see today, isn't it? And we regularly have people asking us, well, where was God when that happened? Or how can you believe, how can you truly believe in a God that holds everything in his hands when that's going on? In fact, it's kind of like sovereignty or coincidence, you might say. The Times this week published a piece stating this. Britain has become one of the most godless nations in the world. James Marriott is the reporter. And he makes a big deal out of the fact that over 50% of the country in the latest polls now say they don't believe in God. The average person in this world is living as if God is gone. They make decisions as if God is missing. And that has an impact on us as well. It's a good job that God has given us Esther to help us think about this topic. Now, a lot of people, when they come to Esther, they get concerned, don't they, that God's name is missing entirely from the book. In fact, this is the only book of the Bible that definitely does not mention God. Song of Songs might, maybe, but Esther definitely doesn't. There is no mention of God's name whatsoever. And so people start to ask the question, why then is this book here? That's what many people throughout history have done. And coupled with that, people also ask the question, well, why is this book even called Esther? When the story seems to be more about Mordecai, or maybe even more about Xerxes. Well, I reckon we can answer that question. We've been beating this drum all the way through. That's because the word Esther is the Hebrew word for hiding. The word Esther, if you were Hebrew, you'd go, well, yeah, it's hiding. Deuteronomy 31, verse 18, God said in the exile, I will certainly Esther my face in that day because of all their wickedness in turning to other gods. See, in the exile, God said he will hide his face from his people. He will Esther his face from his people. And this book, set in exile, seems to have God hiding, doesn't it? It's in the title of the book. How do God's people then live in a world like that? Does that mean that God has stopped caring for his people? Does that mean God stopped caring about his promises? God had made promises to Abraham. He called him out of, that's the name of the place, called him out of Ur, of the Chaldeans. And now Esther and her people, they find themselves in a place called Susa. And if you were to plot that on a map, Ur and Susa, you'd find they're not very far from each other. It's like, say, Albans and Hemel Hempstead. Not very far at all. It's as if in this exile, the people have gone from where Abraham's come from, gone into the promised land, to come all the way back 360 degrees to where they started, now in Susa. And we might feel similar to that. We might feel that this might be the end. Has God given up on his plans? Is God missing? How should God's people live in a world that's missing God? Well, more precisely, how should we tonight live in a world that's missing God? And the answer that the book of Esther gives us is this: by remembering the story of Esther. By remembering the story of Esther. And that makes the fact that Esther is relegated to the bottom of the pile so often all the more sad. Because as we do that, we'll see some amazing things. Let me show us what we've seen. Let's work through the three big bits. By remembering the story of Esther, you'll firstly see the world for what it is. You'll see the world for what it is. Chapters 1 to 4 of Esther give us a picture of what the world looks like. Now, usually when the Bible presents the world to us, it's in order for us to think about ourselves, to think about the way that God's people should be separate from the world. Usually we get into the discussions, don't we? We want to start talking about the world out there, and the preacher, the growth group leader, the teacher says, no, you're meant to be looking at yourself. Stop talking about them, talk about yourselves. But here in Esther chapter 1 to 4, we're actually encouraged to look at the world around us, to see the world around us for what it really is. And that's the place, that is a world where rulers appear godlike. Do you remember Xerxes, Ahasuerus? He is the ruler of the world. There is his empire for you to see on the map. I made this map and I don't think we ever used it. So here we go. There's a map for you. In the time of Esther, he is ruling all the places that you would class as the centre of the world, the middle of the world. Have a look at Esther chapter 1, verse 1. This is what happened during the time of Xerxes. The Xerxes who ruled over 127 provinces stretching from India to Kush, or India to Ethiopia, or however you want to mark that out. And that's really important because it's really important because it includes a little place known as Israel. And if you're part of Xerxes' world, you can't escape that world. And that world is making all of the decisions. That world is ruled by a man who is described in Esther like God. There's language in Esther that's used only of God elsewhere in the Bible. But here in Esther, that language is taken and applied directly to Xerxes. For instance, here's one we didn't talk about too much. Xerxes' anger and the consequences of his anger are made to sound like Noah's flood. The point being, in this world that's missing God, well, the rulers start to take his place. Esther chapter 1, the world belongs to Xerxes. He sits on his throne at the end of 7 days, and he enjoys what he's created. And even if you wanted to escape his world, you can't. However hard you try, you are part of that world. Our world is pretty much like that, isn't it? As the rulers today act as if they're the ones in charge. Here's a rule for you, not one for me. Whether that's the queen, the king, the president, or perhaps the head of the global corporation. I reckon that's why we care so much and we worry so much about politics. Because in this world that is missing God, we can fall into the trap as well of believing that politics, all the things going on around us, are where power really lies. But Esther's telling us this to jolt us out of that. So it's a world where rulers are like God. It's a world also that is harsh and uncaring. Throughout these first few chapters, we saw how the ruler thought about people. As far as Xerxes is concerned, people are stuff. Chapter 1, his wife Vashti being ogled, using the same language as the people looking at the stuff that Xerxes owns, like the golden cups. To the women, chapter 2, who are being stored away like grain in a famine, using the same language of Joseph from Genesis. Or the women being given their beauty treatments. Do you remember that one? It's using the same language there as embalming a dead corpse. Because the empire of the world is harsh. The empire of the world is uncaring. I mean, again, that has a lot to say to our world, doesn't it? I'm not sure much has really changed. And it's a world where there's another story that is running beneath the surface. Have a look at Esther 2, verse 7. Esther 2, verse 7, we meet a woman named Hadassah. But she's also named Esther. She's a picture of a Jewish person with everything that comes with that, whilst also donning this Persian name, the name of Esther. And throughout this book, we are tracking her identity. Is she going to act as one of God's people, or is she going to act as a Persian? And there's the middleman, whose name literally means middle, Hatak, in Esther chapter 4. He runs backwards and forwards between the two, showing us the distance that existed between the queen and the people of God in Esther chapter 4. it would appear that the story of the world, the story of Persia, trumps the story of the Bible, the story of Israel. But God's people have a habit of being like a beach ball, trying to submerge them into the sea, and they just pop up somewhere else. And this language of appearance, remember, that is why Xerxes was so worried about Vashti's refusal. He wanted to appear. He wanted to be seen as being in charge. When Esther was brought into the harem, it was all about what people saw. The story of Persia is the story about what is seen with your eyes. But all the way through Esther, we want to be seeing that underneath the reality is different. So you could sum up like this, and this is what we did. Everything in this world of missing God talks of an alternative Eden with an alternative God. When God is missing, you try and replace him with something else. Xerxes here seems to be God, floating around walking in his garden. And that is the world we live in. That is the world Esther wants us to grapple with. That is the world this book wants to unmask so that we can see that reality underneath. The book of Esther is here to stop us thinking, this is it, I've made it. The book of Esther is here to stop us putting our hope in the here and the now, to stop us trusting in earthly things, or as Yele might say this morning, to set your hearts on things above. But as we think about the world, as we see it for what it really is, that message could be really discouraging, couldn't it? It could be really discouraging unless we get the next point from the book of Esther, which is this. Unless we know that God is in charge. Unless we know that God's in charge. Chapters 5 to 7, we started to focus in as the decree was made against God's people. It seemed like an unstoppable command that is going to wipe out the people of God. Do you remember how serious that was? It's not just a feud between a few people. If that happened, you would lose the entire hope of the gospel. God had made a promise, remember, to raise up a saviour from the Jewish people. And if Haman gets what he wants, the entirety of the Jewish people are wiped out. That promise is over. So the stakes are high. And it turns out that Esther was in a position to do something about that. Esther 4 verse 14. Who knows but that you have come to your royal position for such a time as this? Yeah, the challenge there was who is really in charge? See, Esther 5 verse 1, the royal language gets slapped everywhere, kind of like my house and stickers. If you ever give my daughter stickers, you'll find them everywhere. Royal language gets slapped all over the place. Esther 5 verse 1, is King Xerxes the one in charge? I mean, he is ruling the world. But that idea, it quickly gets squashed as Esther walks into the court. In fact, throughout this book, we find that Xerxes' power is superficial. From the way that Vashti defies him, to the subtle poking the author does, the showing his wife, Esther, is still obeying her uncle instead. He's still obeying the king's command. So Xerxes isn't really in charge. Well, maybe it's Esther then. As well as disobeying the king's command in chapter 5, she didn't answer the king's question. Do you remember there was this question that Xerxes was asking? And she doesn't actually answer the question. So perhaps it's Esther who's in charge. I mean, that's a power play, isn't it? Here's my question, Esther. I'm not going to tell you the answer, king. Power play. Do you remember the ambiguous line, chapter 5, verse 4? Quite important to how the story works. Esther 5, verse 4. If it pleases the king, replied Esther, let the king, together with Haman, come today to a banquet I prepared for him. Well, who's the feast for then, Esther? Is it for the king? Is it for Haman? She explicitly just says, him. But then we remember that Esther isn't in charge as well, because she can do nothing about this decree that is looming over her head. So we think it's Haman. I mean, Haman, he seems to get everything he's after. He might be getting a feast thrown in his honour. He seems to know how to play the system. He seems to know how to play Xerxes to get his wishes. Surely the puppet master is in charge, surely. But then as he walks outside, he sees Mordecai not falling beneath him. And he realises that his king desires are not being played along with. It totally devastates him. So maybe Mordecai's in charge. He looks like the exalted one as he gets put on a horse, wearing the king's clothes. But again, it doesn't work. You could pick all sorts of people who seem to be in charge, but none of them are really in power. You could say the emperor has no clothes. And this leads to the big question of this section. And it runs throughout the book, really. Who is in charge? Well, another unique aspect of this story of Esther is that it uses more passive verbs than any other book in the Bible. A passive verb is a verb that you don't get told the person who's doing it. It's just being done to a person. Things just happen. Like Poirot would ask, who done it? Well, probably not like that. You need to twirl the moustache and say in Belgian. But the whole thing is, who did it? Something's happened. This comes to a head in chapter 6, verse 1. Probably the turning point of the book of Esther. That night, the king could not sleep. So he ordered the book of the Chronicles, the record of his reign, to be brought in and read to him. Do you remember the moment that the king couldn't sleep? Or when the whole story turned on its head, when the reversals began, all because mighty King Xerxes could not sleep. In fact, if you read the literal language, it says the sleep was taken from the king. Later versions of Esther, versions written after the exile, start to add in extra words, and they make it explicit for us. They say, God took the sleep away from the king. The original version of Esther leaves it ambiguous. We're meant to be asking ourselves, coincidence? Or is someone else really in charge? When we begin to ask that, in fact, we've been asking it the whole time, we go back through the whole book, and we see that everything, absolutely everything, has been working towards keeping God's promises. Because God might be missing, he might be hiding his face, but everything still seems to work to bring about what God promises. So theologically, we want to land on the point that God is in charge, even if you can't see it. And that big promise of rest, in Esther chapter 3, verse 8, Haman said, we want to deny the rest to the people. Well, that rest ultimately gets granted by God. As Haman's wife notes, Esther 6, 13, we summed up as your numpty, but here's what she actually says. Since Mordecai, before whom your downfall has started, is of Jewish seed, Jewish origin, you cannot stand against him. You will surely come to ruin. As all the stories behind the surface are ticking along, the story of Joseph is there, the story of Joshua, the story of King David, and all those others playing in the background, the story lurking under the surface says Mordecai is of Jewish origin, since he is part of this big story that God is running under the seams, you're going to come to ruin. And that leads us to our final lesson of Esther. Know that God is in charge, because that happens so we can remember that God does act in history. Remember that God does act in history. I've been reflecting a bit more on Esther since we've worked through it. I think, I'm still up in the air with this, I think that Esther's story, the story of one of God's people who does the right thing at the right time, models what all the people are expected to do at the end of the book. Remember, Esther had to decide which side she's going to be on. Is she going to be Queen Esther of Persia or Esther of the Jewish people? And as I said, that situation lands in the laps of the people of God at the end of the book, as those two decrees stand simultaneously. One to exterminate God's people, and the other to stand with God's people. Either God's people fall or God's people stand. And the people have to make a decision, considering which they believe to be true. And in that world missing God, in this world missing God, that is a decision we have to make too. But it is a scary decision, in the not knowing what our friends or our neighbours are going to do. But God does keep his promises, and he acts in history to protect his people and to give them victory. And that all ended with the Festival of Purim, the festival that remembers just how close God's people, God's promises were to being wiped out. The festival that remembers that God still keeps his promises. But as we saw last week, with most of Esther, you could tell that story a different way. Oh, it's just chance, isn't it? Oh, it was just good luck. Oh, it's just coincidence. It's a bit like the film About Time. I don't know if anyone's seen that film. It's a great film. Premise is that the main character can go back in time to change how things work out. But at the end of the film, this is not a spoiler, don't worry, he gets some advice from his dad. And I think this advice is similar to what we get told in Esther here. The character in About Time is told, go and live the day, and then, with your time-travelling skills, go back and live the day again. But the second time, look at all the good things that are happening. Enjoy knowing what's going to happen. See, the book of Esther is calling God's people to look harder, to see how God is using all things for the good of those who love him. In the situations that seem difficult, in the situations that seem scary, where God at first glance is missing, at the end of the day, at the end of a horrible day, go back and notice that God was there all along. That was true in Susa. It's true in Hemel Hempstead. But not only that, look for the promises still to come. Chapter 10, the book finishes on a positive note, but there are still some niggles that make you wonder if that's really true. We're meant to keep trusting God's promises. For God's people, it means not settling for a Saul-like king. That's what Mordecai is like here. A Saul-like king, no matter how good he is, don't settle for that. Don't settle for a Xerxes-like king, no matter how powerful he is, no matter how much of the world he owns. Instead, look for the promised king who's going to reign the world in righteousness and justice. Great David's greater son. And don't settle for this world, for this earth right now. But instead, look to the new creation where this world will be transformed, where the true king will be in charge, where God has acted ultimately in history. Because when God acts ultimately in history, there will no longer be any curse. The throne of God and of the Lamb will be in his city, and his servants will serve him. And they will see his face. The end of history, Revelation 22, God will Esther no longer. They will see his face. See how this points us forward? So as we finish this book of Esther this evening, let us look forward to that day when God will not Esther any longer. And let's live our lives in this world, missing God, seeing the world for what it is, knowing that God is in charge, and remembering that God does act in history.
Thank you so much for listening. Any feedback or questions can be sent to podcast@david-couch.com, and I'll catch you again next time.